Historical What Ifs. Historical What Ifs.
History hinges on moments so small they could fit in the palm of your hand, yet their consequences echo through centuries and shape the world we live in today. This is Historical What Ifs, where we explore the alternate timelines that could have emerged from a single different decision, a missed opportunity, or a stroke of luck that went the other way. Today's episode examines one of those pivotal moments and traces the extraordinary chain of events that might have followed if history had taken just one small turn in a different direction. Welcome to Historical What Ifs, reimagining pivotal moments.
Imagine for a moment, the year is 1588, but the story we all know, the story of plucky English ships and a Protestant wind, is not the one being told. Instead, the greatest naval fleet ever assembled, the Spanish Armada, stands victorious in the English Channel.
It's a chilling thought. For me, as a storyteller, the defeat of the Armada is one of history's great David and Goliath tales. It's so ingrained in the English-speaking world's psyche. So the question that's always fascinated me is, what happens to the story when Goliath actually wins?
Exactly. And from a historical perspective, it's a moment where the path of the future forks so dramatically. The English victory wasn't just a military outcome. It was a catalyst that shaped everything from the future of Protestantism to the dawn of the British Empire. My interest has always been in that single pivotal point of divergence. If we flip that one result, the entire world map looks different.
It really does. What would the reign of King Philip of England and Spain look like? What becomes of Queen Elizabeth I, the so-called heretic queen?
And what about the New World? Does the British colonial project ever even get off the ground? These are the turbulent waters we're going to navigate today.
We're going to dismantle the legend and build a new, unseen history from the ground up, exploring what might have been if the Invincible Armada had lived up to its name. The consequences are staggering, and they ripple out across centuries.
It's a scenario that reshapes not just a nation, but the entire balance of global power. So, let's set our course for this alternate 1588 and see what we find.
So, let's dive right in. The Spanish fleet has won the Battle of Gravelines. They control the channel. Lord Howard's ships are scattered, crippled, or sunk. What happens on day one of this new reality? What's the first move on the chessboard?
The first move isn't another naval battle. It's a link-up. The entire purpose of the Armada, which we often forget, wasn't to conquer England from the sea. It was to be the world's most formidable ferry service.
A ferry service for the Duke of Parma's army in the Netherlands.
Exactly. For his 30,000 elite troops, the Tercios. These aren't the green militia Elizabeth was trying to rally. These are the most feared soldiers in Europe, hardened by decades of war in Flanders. They would have landed in Kent, likely near Margate, and their objective would be singular.
And the English defense, we have this romantic image of Elizabeth's speech at Tilbury, the heart and stomach of a king. But that speech is delivered to what? 4,000 or 5,000 militiamen.
And it's delivered in our timeline after the immediate danger has passed. In this scenario, that speech becomes something else entirely. It's not a victory cry. It's a eulogy. Or maybe a desperate last-ditch attempt to inspire a force that is, frankly, completely outmatched.
So, the march on London is it even a contest?
I struggle to see how. The English had courage, no doubt. But Parma's army had discipline, experience, and superior logistics. It would be a brutal, bloody, but likely very short campaign across the southeast of England. The key question for me isn't if they take London, but what happens to the Queen while they're taking it.
Right. Because that's the symbolic heart of the kingdom. Does Elizabeth stay in the city? Does she retreat north to try and rally the country and wage a guerrilla war? What is her character's motivation here? Survival or martyrdom?
That is the billion-dollar question. If she flees, England is plunged into a devastating civil war, a Catholic Spanish-controlled South versus a Protestant loyalist North. It would make the Wars of the Roses look tame.
But if she's captured, oh, the sheer drama of that. The heretic queen in the hands of Philip II's generals. What do they even do with her?
They wouldn't kill her. I don't think so. Not immediately. Philip's primary goal was religious and political, not purely vindictive. She would be an immensely powerful bargaining chip. The plan would likely be to force her to abdicate, to nullify the Protestant succession, and to legitimize a new Catholic monarch.
And who would that be? Mary, Queen of Scots, is already dead by this point. That was one of the major catalysts for the Armada in the first place.
It was. And her execution removes the most obvious Catholic claimant. So Philip would likely turn to his own daughter, the Infanta Isabella Clara Eugenia. He would argue her claim through her descent from the House of Lancaster.
A Spanish queen on the throne of England, imposed by an invading army. I can't even fathom the public reaction to that. The resistance would have been biblical.
It would be a national trauma from which England might never recover. Every aspect of the national identity we know, forged in the crucible of that victory, is instead melted down and recast in a Spanish mold. The Protestant-led, Parliament-governed, seafaring nation, it dies before it's even truly born.
That phrase, melted down and recast, it's terrifying. Because you're not just talking about a change in government, you're talking about an assault on the very soul of a place. What happens to the language, to the stories? Does Shakespeare, who is just a young man at this point, ever write about English kings in the way we know? Or does he write passion plays approved by Spanish censors?
I think it's highly unlikely he becomes the Shakespeare we know. The entire cultural flowering of the late Elizabethan and Jacobean era is fueled by that post-Armada confidence, that sense of divine favor and national destiny. You take that away and you replace it with subjugation and a foreign imposed faith, the creative energy either goes underground, becoming a literature of protest and rebellion, or it adapts to serve the new regime.
So, instead of Henry V, you get a play celebrating the piety of the Infanta Isabella.
Or more likely, the works of Lope de Vega and Calderón de la Barca are imported and become the dominant theatrical force in London. The English language itself would be flooded with Spanish loanwords, not just for military or administrative terms, but for concepts of faith, honor, and art. It would fundamentally alter its trajectory.
Wow. And this isn't a slow, organic change. This is a shock to the system. You're talking about the machinery of the Counter-Reformation being imported wholesale. What does that look like for the average person in, say, Norwich or York?
It looks like the Inquisition. Maybe not the full Spanish Inquisition in its most brutal form, but certainly a version of it. You'd have commissions established to root out heresy. Parish priests would be replaced. The Book of Common Prayer would be outlawed, and the Latin Mass reinstated. For the average person, it would be a terrifying and disorienting reversal of everything they've known for the past 50 years.
So, you'd have neighbors informing on neighbors for secretly reading an English Bible.
You would. And you'd have a new class of English Catholic administrators, the ones who kept the faith in secret, suddenly elevated to positions of power. Think of it as the dissolution of the monasteries under Henry VIII, but played in reverse. Instead of tearing down monasteries, the Spanish-English regime would be rebuilding them, restaffing them, and returning church lands.
That would create a permanent, simmering resentment, wouldn't it? An entire class of gentry and landowners who rose on the back of that confiscated church land would suddenly be dispossessed.
It's the perfect recipe for perpetual rebellion. Philip wouldn't just conquer England, he'd have to occupy it. Parma's 30,000 troops wouldn't be going home. They'd become a permanent garrison, propping up a deeply unpopular Catholic monarchy. Every village, could become a potential flashpoint.
It's fascinating because in our timeline, England's anti-Catholicism and its sense of national identity become inextricably linked for centuries. It sounds like in this version, that linkage is forged even earlier, but in the fires of a brutal occupation rather than a triumphant victory.
Exactly. English Protestantism becomes a religion of rebellion, of martyrdom. The heretic label, which Philip intended as a condemnation, becomes a badge of honor for those fighting a foreign Catholic king. The very nature of English identity is still forged in opposition to Spain. But it's the identity of an oppressed people, not a rising power.
And that identity, that of an oppressed people, it doesn't stay confined to England, does it? The ripple effect from a conquered Britain has to be global. We've been focused on London, but what does this mean for the Americas?
Oh, the New World is unrecognizable. The entire English colonial project is stillborn. There's no Jamestown. There's no Plymouth Rock. The colonies that were just desperate little footholds, like Roanoke, are wiped from the map without a second thought.
So the whole story of North America, the English language, common law, the 13 colonies, it just doesn't happen.
It doesn't. North America becomes the next great prize for an unchallenged Spain. The French in Quebec and the Dutch in New Amsterdam are suddenly very, very small fish in a massive Spanish lake. They're squeezed between Spanish Florida and a Spanish-controlled England that can project power into the North Atlantic. Their colonial ambitions are likely curtailed, if not snuffed out entirely.
So you're looking at a continent that is, for all intents and purposes, entirely Ibero-Catholic, from Patagonia to the Arctic Circle.
That's the trajectory. And what does that do to Spain itself? In our timeline, the Armada's failure is often seen as the peak, the beginning of the long, slow decline. But in this one?
In this one, their golden century gets a massive extension. They've eliminated their primary naval rival, decapitated the Protestant cause in Europe, and secured the sea lanes to their American empire. They are an unchallengeable hyperpower.
For a time, I think so. But, and this is the point where I start to wonder, does this victory actually save Spain? Or does it just accelerate its overextension? The cost of occupying England, of fighting a permanent insurgency there, while still trying to suppress the Dutch revolt, it's astronomical.
That's a brilliant point. It's not a clean win. It's trading one problem, a rival nation, for another, much larger one, a permanent, festering wound in the form of an occupied, rebellious England that drains the treasury year after year.
It's the classic imperial dilemma. It's possible that Philip's victory contains the seeds of a different, perhaps even more spectacular collapse a century down the line. A collapse from internal rot and imperial exhaustion, rather than external defeat.
So, in the end, maybe the fundamental story arc doesn't change, just the details and the timing of the fall. Still, it's just staggering to contemplate. We started this whole discussion with a single naval battle, and we've ended up redrawing the entire map of the world, changing languages, religions, the very stories nations tell themselves.
And what's truly unsettling is that in that timeline, our world, the one we're living in, would be the impossible, almost laughable, what if. They'd be the ones making podcasts about the absurd idea of a tiny island nation defeating the Armada and somehow building a global empire.
The idea that we are the alternate history. Wow. That's a chilling thought to end on.
It is. It proves history isn't a straight line. It's a web of these fragile, contingent moments. And 1588? Well, it might just be the most fragile and consequential of them all. The butterfly effect of history reminds us that the world we know today is just one of countless possibilities, shaped by moments of chance, choice, and consequence that could have easily gone another way. This has been Historical What Ifs, where every episode reveals how fragile our timeline really is, and how different decisions by our ancestors might have created an entirely different present. Understanding these alternate possibilities doesn't just satisfy our curiosity. It helps us appreciate how remarkable it is that we ended up in this particular version of history.